Our speaker this morning is Janet D. from Pittsburgh, PA. Since we heard Jack last night, I'm real anxious to hear Janet's story this morning. So I give you Janet.
Good morning. I'm a member of the Plum Unity Al-Anon Family Group in Pittsburgh, and my name is Janet Dempsey.
Hi,
thank you. I kept sitting over there in the dining hall looking at that sign that said, "We love you in wild, wonderful West Virginia." And I kept looking at it and looking at it, and I said to myself, "They really do. And there's nothing to be afraid of." But I still feel this way. When we got here yesterday, Vi said to me, "Have you ever been here before?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you and Jack won't be staying together, and it's like roughing it. Do you think you could handle that?" And that's kind of like what my husband did. He said, "Roughing it." She lived with me for many years. So I can rough it. I've done that before. I love coming to West Virginia. Driving down here, it's just awesome, the scenery. Reminded me of my father, because it's been 8 years now since my father died, and he was like a real special person to me, and it's 8 years this month. And he came from a coal mining town, and he was one of those that they call him a hillbilly. And he was one of nine children, and I can remember all of them sitting around at night playing the guitars and singing all these country and western songs. And I grew up hearing them, and I just love it. I loved it when they sang "Please Release Me." I thought that was such a beautiful song. And I didn't know later on when I grew up I would be singing it and begging somebody to do that. When I was growing up, everything was fine in my family. My father went to work. My mother stayed home. And she was always there. She never went out to work. And I have one brother who's younger than myself. And my family life was pretty nice. And I was only 14 years old when I met Jack. And I knew when I first met him that I loved him and I was going to marry him. 14 years old. And now I think about that and I think, my God, I was a baby. And at the time, he told me that he was 15. First he said, "How old are you?" I said, 14. He said, "Oh, I'm 15. So it was about a year later, I guess, he told me that he was a year younger than I was. But he didn't want to tell me that right away. But as soon as I saw him, I knew right away that he needed me. His pants weren't pressed right, you know. And like he told you, he had a tough home life. And he had to eat fast foods, and he had to get up for school by himself in the morning, and there just was no one to take care of him. And because I did so well at home, and my family was always behind me with whatever I wanted to do, I could do anything, so I could take care of this person. Now, this person talked a whole lot about going into the service to get out of this home. And I kept this to myself, but I said, "You're not going into the service. We are going to get married. And I don't know if you are going to think that I won or I lost, but we got married." And I think what we did is we proceeded to raise one another because we were 17 and 18 years old. Now, I had visions of what this marriage was going to be like. I was going to do what my mother did. He was going to do what my father did. And my children were going to do what I did. Because I was perfect. I was a good little girl. I listened. And he would come home for dinner every night. And we would say grace. And we would eat our meal. Put the children to bed early. And we would cuddle up on the couch in this little house with the nice white fence around it. And this was going to be what we were going to do. But it seems that, like, Jack had other plans. He didn't think like I did. I thought he did, but he didn't. I think that it was only probably about 15 months that we were married. Now, when I first got married, I laughed a lot. I had a sense of humor. I enjoyed everything. I had a lot of confidence in me. And here I am, married about 15 months. I wasn't laughing anymore. There was nothing funny happening in my life. And I didn't understand what it was. I just didn't know what it was. Because at that time, the drinking wasn't heavy. Just a little bit here or there. And the, I'm sorry, I won't do that again. And of course, I believed him. I loved him. And he was a good person. And I believed it. But he was also a playboy. I called him a playboy. He played the drums in the band. He went out a lot. And he was getting ready to go this one night. And he just got out of the shower, and I'm standing there ironing his white shirt. And my hair was long then, and it was stringing. And I'm sweating, and I put the baby in the crib so she wouldn't get burnt with the iron. And he's screaming at me to hurry up and get this shirt ironed. I got real angry. So we argued a little bit, and I just, like, ripped the iron out of the wall and backed him into the corner. And I told him he wasn't going anywhere. And at this point, I think he... Oh, there's an ant crawling up here. I think he knew I meant it because I was crazy. And if he wouldn't have done what he did, I think he'd have had the mark of an iron on his chest today. But he just said, I'm not going anywhere tonight, honest. And he stayed home. There's just, the hairs got singed a little bit, but that's all that happened with that. But you see, I thought that was a good way to keep him home when I wanted him home. But I couldn't keep a hot iron plugged in all the time because I had a little girl who was walking around. So that wasn't going to work too good. I tried talking to Jack a lot because I thought if he would just listen to me, everything would be all right because I did everything right. You know, I was perfect. I was good. Just listen to me and everything's going to be wonderful. So I try to talk to him and tell him, you know, I think you're drinking a little bit too much. And he'd say, yeah, I know, I'm going to have to cut down and, you know, in the beginning. And he would cut down a little bit. So I thought, well, I am powerful. He does listen to me. But as time went on, he wasn't listening to me anymore. And I had to think of ways to get him to stop drinking. Very quick, I learned I couldn't do that. So maybe to slow him down a little bit. Maybe I could do that. Different ways I tried to do that was I fed him a lot of spaghetti because he loved it. And when he was done eating spaghetti, he couldn't drink. And I found that out because we went out visiting one night. And he was asked, first thing everywhere we went, Jack, would you like a beer? And that night he said, no, I can't. He said, I just ate spaghetti. So I found another answer, and I made spaghetti probably 3 times a week for years. And he found a way to get around that, like everything else. I was getting lonely because he was never around. I was starting to become afraid of everything. And everybody. I was afraid if I went outside, people would ask me where he was and what he was doing because I was an extension of him. And I lied. I lied a lot because I didn't want people to know that I was married to this kind of person. So I would tell them that he was working overtime. He worked 16 hours straight, and he's tired. That's why he parked on your hedges. And he asked me if I would please go out and repark the car. He went straight to bed. He's sound asleep. He was passed out on the floor. But I told him he was sound asleep because he worked so hard. I couldn't make him stop. And so I had to get even. I had a lot of frustration. And I had to get rid of it somehow. And I couldn't hit him because he's bigger than I am. And I don't want him to hit me back. So I had to think of ways that I could get even without him knowing. Now, he told you the story about the zoo. Sundays was my day to get even. And I would get even on that day. Now, if he would listen to me and do what I wanted him to do, then he wouldn't get punished on Monday. But there was times that he would go to the club on Sunday, and then he had to be punished. And how I did that is Mondays when I got up to do the wash, I would start his shorts and his socks. And I was getting even with him, but he didn't know it. So I'm getting rid of my frustrations. And most of the time, he'd sit on the side of the bed, and he didn't know what day it was, what time it was. And he'd say these feel a little stiff. And say, rub them together a little bit. They'll be all right. And he would. And he'd wear them. And I wonder why, I don't know why he changed the shorts in gas stations. That might have had something to do with it because they were too stiff. I don't know. I know when he stayed out late at night, I'd wait up. I didn't care if he was out till 4 o'clock in the morning. I would wait because I had to tell him he was drunk again. Because I was afraid he didn't realize how many times he was doing this. And one of these days, he would hear me, and he would say, you know, you're right, I'm going to have to quit. He never quit. But I never quit either. I kept staying up. While I was up, I was doing things like I was waxing the kitchen floor. And as that coat dried, if he wasn't home yet, it got another coat. And the longer he stayed up, the more coats of wax got on there. And then I laid down the little throw rugs. And then I'd go upstairs to wait for him to come in. And I was getting even and I was having fun. Because he came in and he took many rides on the throw rugs. And I'd hear it. I'd hear the banging and, you know, the falling and the swearing and, you know. And I was upstairs doing the grinning, you know. And I'd pretend I was asleep at times like that because I didn't want him to know that I was doing this because he might get angry with me and I was afraid. I didn't know what to do about this drinking, so I said, let's talk again, and he said, fine. And he'd listen to anything I had to say as long as I added, you can drink. I said, would you mind drinking at home? Because if you drink at home, then we won't have all these wrecked cars, and I won't have to go get you out of another jackpot with my rent money, and I'll even buy the booze and bring it home. He said, fine. See, in there was you can drink. So he stayed home. He come home Friday after work. And I went out and I bought the beer and the whiskey and brought it home and set it down. And I said, now this is going to be wonderful. I'm not going to have to worry anymore. You don't have to worry. I'm not going to nag you anymore. It's going to be great. Here, start drinking. So he started drinking, and he drank Friday. We don't go to bed when we're drinking, so we were up all night Friday night drinking. By Saturday evening, he was out of booze. He's sitting there in his undershirt. He needed a shave. He was complaining, and I started to nag, because I said, get the hell out of my house and go drink somewhere else, because that's not what I wanted. I did not want him there drinking. I wanted him there not drinking. And I couldn't have that. So out on the streets again he went, and I was happy because I didn't want him there all the time. And he continued doing this, and I started doing things like 90-degree weather. I would like close the drapes and the doors and keep my little girl in. She was like 5 years old, and I wouldn't let her go outside and play because I might have to go out and find her. And then they'd ask me again about him. It was always him. It was never me. Someone would say, "How are you?" "Oh, you'll never believe what Jack did." You know, that was my answer. Because I didn't have me. I didn't know who I was. I was always trying to fix him. And I didn't think I needed fixing. I never gave myself a thought. But what he was doing was socially unacceptable. And I could see it, and so could the world. And I was trying to fix him so he would be acceptable to somebody. I don't even know if it was going to be me, but to somebody. His mother came out to visit us a lot. She lived in Chicago and still does. And I used to write her letters. When I'd get to the end of my rope, I would write her a letter. And she worked for the railroad. So she would immediately jump on a train, and she would come out, and she would try to fix it. And he has a lot of respect for his mother, and he listened. And she'd go home, and maybe 3 days he wouldn't drink, and it would start up again. So I did this to her for probably about 4 years running. And the one time I called her, and she didn't come. And I called her again. I said, "When are you coming?" And she said, "I'm not." She said, "I think that you and I are both married to drinking men," which she was and still is, "and I think we're just going to have to learn to accept it." Huh. I said, "Maybe you are, but I'm not." So I said, "You can count on me not writing you any more letters or calling you. I ain't telling you nothing." So that's probably the best thing I ever did for the woman. She had her own problems, and I was giving her mine too. So I left her alone, so she was no answer. But the one time she was here, we had one of these talks, and my husband said, "Look, there's no problem. Don't worry about it." He said, I'm blowing up drinking all this. One of these days, I'm just going to burst, and it's going to be all over, and you'll have everything." And I said, "Just don't blow up in my house because I ain't cleaning the mess." And that's the way I felt. I felt that way. And his mother, now this is his mother, she said, "Jack, if you're going to do it now. Because the girl's only 25 years old, she can get herself another man." So you see, I thought I was right. If it was his mother saying this, I had to be right. His grandmother helped me. She used to tell me to feed him some grease before he went out to drink. Coat his stomach. But I couldn't figure what I could tell him. How could I tell him to sit down and eat this stick of margarine? You know? What for? But nothing changed because of these talks, naturally. I asked him why he drank so much. And he said, "Do you really want to know?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, then I'll tell you." He said, "I drink because when I come home from work sometimes you have rollers in your hair." And he said, "That makes me get drunk." So I decided, what I did about that was I made a standing appointment at the beauty shop for one solid year. And every week I got the guy that owned the place to give me a special, different hairdo. And he was still drinking over here. And I'm over here getting these hairdos. But see, I thought that the right hairdo was going to do it. And I kept trying. It didn't do it. After a year, I didn't have any more money to do this, so I had to quit doing that. I had to get on with something else. Try something else. And I remember telling him that we were... No, I said, "We're two unlucky people. And if we ever reach our 13th wedding anniversary, I think it would be real nice for us if we had a divorce reception. And he agreed with that, sure. I said, that way you could get up front, you could sit there and play your drums and do your thing, and I'll do mine. He said, fine. And you know, it wasn't until I got into Al-Anon and I realized I didn't have a thing to do. My thing was watching what he did and how much he drank. So if we would have had enough money to have this divorce reception, I would have had nothing to do anyway. So I guess it was best. But these are the kind of thoughts I had and the attitudes that I had. I was just so fearful all the time, and I was just so lonely. And I remember begging him to stay home, and every once in a while he would. But you know, the strangest thing happened. When he was home, I was just as lonely, if not worse. Because the whole time he was there, I kept studying him, because I knew he was going to go out. I knew it. And he always told me that I would never make a pipe and slipper man out of him. So what he did is he kept his shoes on with the shoes untied so they'd be nice and loose, but they were on for a quick getaway. And when he bent over to tie his shoes, I knew he was going out. So I'd sit there all night and watch him, because I knew sooner or later he was going to bend over and tie them shoes, and I lost. And as soon as he'd bend over to tie them shoes, I'd say, why are you going out and get drunk again? And he'd say, what are you talking about? I said, you're going out to drink. He said, well, I wasn't, but I will now. And he did, but I knew when he tied his shoes, he was going to get drunk. That came right along with it. Tie your shoes, get drunk. And I made a study of this person, and I knew all these things about him, and I knew what was going to happen. And they always did. I remember one time he told me he was going to quit drinking. Just have a few at night with his wife, a few cocktails. Oh, wonderful. I didn't even drink, you know, but he was just going to have a couple. So he comes home this one night, and he sits down in the chair, and he takes this pipe out, and he lights his pipe. He never smoked a pipe in his life. He's going to become this pipe and slipper man, see? And I smelled it, and I said, it smells real sweet. He said, yeah, it's a special kind of stuff they have out now, and I thought I'd try it. He went out and he fixed himself one mixed drink, and he sat there and he drank that. It was a water glass, and he smoked a pipe, and he couldn't walk. One drink. And see, he knew I didn't drink, so he fixed a big water glass full of gin, and he put one shot of whiskey in it so that the color was light, so that I would know that there wasn't much whiskey in it, see. And he couldn't walk, but that's why he was smoking marijuana in the pipe, you know. And he drank all that gin with the whiskey in it, and I'm wondering why he's crawling up the steps. And you know, all these times I'm trying to get this man to quit drinking, and one day he comes home and he decides, I'm going to make beer, and you're going to help me. So he drinks enough quart bottles first to get empties for the beer. Okay. Made plans. We had a whole coal cellar full of empty quart beer bottles when we moved. That's what was left after the beer was made. So he gets this all together and he puts a bobber in it, and he said, now you watch that day and night, and when that bobber comes up, you reach me no matter where I am, because it has to be bottled immediately. I could never find him. I panicked. Oh my God, Jack, what am I going to do if it comes up and you're not around? You find me, he said. You just make sure you find me. Oh. So I was very fortunate because I was up and down him steps, I don't know how many times a day, watching his barber. Now I'm trying to get him to quit drinking, and I'm watching his barber, you know. I was lucky because the day that it came up, he was home because he was working 4 to 12 and he didn't leave yet. And I yelled, "It's up, it's up." God. So he comes downstairs. He lays on the cellar floor. He's going to start siphoning this now, okay? I didn't know. I was so naive and ignorant about a lot of things. I didn't know once you start a siphon, it keeps going. He told me he had a siphon every bottle, which he did. And when he was done, he couldn't get up off the floor. He couldn't move. And he puked green. Nobody else drank his beer. Just him. And he only drank it in an emergency, so you knew it had to be bad. But I helped make it. You know, oh, God. So he was going to die in a car accident, he told me, because then I would get double indemnity. The house would be mine. I would live happily ever after, you see. And I hated the house. It was filled with wall-to-wall water bugs. I'd have to put blue powder down around the rug to get rid of the water bugs. And while I'm getting rid of the water bugs, I had this baby that I had to keep in the playpen so she wouldn't get near that poison. And then I'd run a sweeper and pick it all out and put the baby back out, and then the water bugs would come back. So to live happily ever after in a place like this, you know, where the grass was 3 feet high, we had a refrigerator on the porch, and we had some tires out there also, you know, little things that got neglected were laying around, holes in the hedges, and our next door neighbor would cut our hedges because he was trying to sell his house, you know. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. And I used a lot of the rent money to pay bondsmen and things like that, you know. And if I could get a hold of any money, because I didn't work. I was at home and I tried to get everything I could off of him, and what I got, that's what I managed with. So I have been known to rough it a few times. What happened? He wasn't killing himself and he wasn't going anywhere. And he wanted me to do it and I wouldn't do it for him. And so I decided that maybe it's a good idea if, you know, I go, because I don't like living like this anymore. I'm not really talking to anybody except my neighbor ladies, and their husbands was in the same position. And I used to be the person who went around picking drunks up. The worst neighborhood in the neighborhood, there was always one drunk that was the worst that night. And since I was the only one that knew how to drive, I would go pick up the worst drunk and bring him home. That's what I did. And I was getting a little bit tired of this, so it's time that I go. Now, the only thing I ever did was sit on a couch, watch TV with my children. That was it. And my little girl, I guess my oldest, was about 11 at that time. And I put her through the ringer. And when she was 10 years old, I used to ask her if we should get a divorce or not. And she'd cry and she'd say, "Yeah, Mommy, I can't stand living here anymore." And I'd say, "Fine, that's what we'll do. We'll get a divorce." And then she'd start crying because she didn't want to leave her dad. He needed her. And she loved him. And then I'd say, "Fine, then we won't get a divorce." And I was letting a 10-year-old make my decisions for me. And she was about 11 at this time when I decided it was time to go. And I watched television, and I don't like pain, so I did see this girl in a movie. She turned the oven on and laid her head in there, and she went to sleep, and it looked painless. And I just wanted out, but I didn't want to hurt while I was going out. So I thought, that's a good idea, that's what I'll do. But at the time, I just had one of those little ovens. And I had to take, at this time I had two girls, and I had to take them with me because I couldn't leave them with him, because he was irresponsible, you see. So I thought, how am I going to get these three heads in the oven at the same time? And I knew this girl that was 11 was going to fight the one that was, you know, 2. I figured, you know, I could manage to keep her head in there. And while I was making plans to do this that night, I got a phone call. Someone was looking for Jack, a friend of his, and I didn't know where he was. And he said, I'm going to look for him. And I said, please don't look for him, because if you find him, don't bring him here. I don't want him. And he said, I'm coming, Don. I'm coming, Don. He came down, and he brought his wife down to keep me company while he was out looking for Jack. And I didn't want him to do this anyway. And I didn't want company because I'm trying to plan my, you know, death here. And he brought her in. He carried her in. And she was full of tranquilizers, and he asked me if I'd take care of her while he was out looking for Jack. So it was like somebody needed me here. I couldn't kill myself, you know. So I had to stay alive to take care of her, you know. And then the next day it was on to something else, you know. And I didn't go through with it that night. It's obvious. And a few days later, I don't know what happened to me. I think I reached my bottom, and I just like fell on the floor and started to cry. I couldn't talk. I couldn't get up. I couldn't do anything. And my daughter kept trying to talk to me, and I couldn't answer. And she called my mother, who lived like 10 minutes away from me at the time. And my mother came right down, and my mother was like, she didn't know what was going on, because I really didn't get into anything with her about that. I know she heard things from the grapevine, but I never told her. So I went home with her. She got a brown paper bag and put some clothes in it and took me and the kids up her house. And at that point, I had stopped smoking for 4 months because, you know, when my life got screwed up, I could handle and fix anything. And one thing bad about me was I smoked, so I quit, which didn't help my nerves anymore. So I went up there, and she gave me a pack of cigarettes, and she gave me 2 drinks, and I was on the couch. And all I told my mother was, you know, Mom, don't worry about it, because I gave up all the excuses that I had to stay because my children needed food in their mouth, and they needed a roof over their head. And I gave all that up. Quit saying that. Now I'm done. I'm done. I have to do something now for me and my kids. I don't know what that's going to be, but I'm going to do something. And it was like 3 days before Christmas, so naturally, it's always a bad time, too, you know. And so I got a couple phone calls from him, but he didn't notice I was gone for 3 days. And when he found out I was gone, he called naturally. But I thought that was a lot of rejection. You know, I'm gone for 3 days. You don't even know it. So anyhow, it's a long story, but about a month later, I guess I did come back home because he wanted to go see a psychiatrist and all these things. So I come back home to start on this kind of a road. And they didn't help. They got worse. And one morning he got up, and I'll never forget it because it was my father's birthday. And it was always somebody's birthday, some holiday, that there was this big crisis, you know, and everybody was going to know. And he got up and he said, I'm going to give you a divorce. I'm leaving. And I was happy because I thought that's the first time I think that he's made a decision for years. And I was real glad about that. I felt comfortable. So I just took the kids and I went to my mother and dad's for dinner. And about 4 hours later, the phone rang, and it was for me. And it was this neighbor of ours who had been in AA. And when I heard his voice, I just started to cry. Because I just knew that Jack had to be there, and that's what it was about. And he told me Jack wanted to talk to me, and I said, I have nothing to say to him. And God bless my mother. She was in the background, and she yelled, why don't you ask him if he wants to come up for dinner? And that's all I said. And he came up. Now, he started going to AA, and I thought, now this is it. This is going to be really wonderful. Our lives are going to be fine because he's going to not drink. And I thought that's all there was to it, not drinking. So it was wonderful. And he went, and I did know, though, honestly, did know that there was a difference between all the other things and all the other times that he said, I'm sorry, I'm going to quit. This time it was different because I saw it in his eyes. There was something different about AA. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know who the people were. I was afraid of them. I thought it was going to cost a lot of money, which we didn't have. And he went, he asked me to go a couple weeks later, and I went, and someone asked me if I knew anything about Al-Anon, and I didn't. So they told me it was for the friends and the families of alcoholics. And so I thought, well, I'll try it. I have nothing to lose. I have no place to go. I have nothing to do. So I went. Really and truly, I thought it was like a tea and sympathy kind of thing. That you sat around and drank some tea and sympathized with one another for living like this all these years. And I went, and that's not what it was. They were reading the 12 steps, and they were reading the 12 traditions. And I thought, how dumb. They don't know. I've been to AA, and I know those are for people who drink. And they don't know that yet. But I was new, so I thought, well, I'll hold back on telling them till later. You know, I really believe that. Meanwhile, this AA is not all that wonderful because he hasn't changed much at all. He's just not drinking. And he's arguing with me every day. We had our daily arguments all the time. Never ate a meal where the food went down. Never. It was always something. And every time we'd argue, he would say, if you argue with me again, I'm going to get drunk. And immediately my stomach would tighten up and I'd get sick. I'd run to the door and I'd beg him not to go out. Oh God, please don't do that. And he was doing this to me all the time. And I found an answer for that in the program. They just told me. As a matter of fact, it was his first sponsor that told me. He said, you know, he says, he's hanging this over your head. He says, now the next time he says that, all you have to do is point to the door and say, there is the door. If you would like to go drink, just don't let that door hit you in the ass on the way out. And I said, no, I can't do that. I said, oh God, no, I can't, because if I do, he'll go drink. And he said, well, did you ever tell him not to drink before? I said, yeah, quite a few times. He said, what did he do? I said, he drank. He said, then try it. And you know, I had to try it because I didn't know what to do anymore. And I got my chance. Got my chance that day, because there we were again, right in it. And he said, if you fight with me again, I'm going to get drunk. And I swallowed, and I almost cried, but I didn't let the tears come down. And I knew I had to say it, because there was nothing else to do. And I said it, there's the door, Jack. If you want a drink, just don't let it hit in the ass on the way out. And you know what? It worked. Because he looked at me like I was insane. It was so wonderful. His eyes got big as saucers. And he looked at me and he said, nobody can make me drink if I don't want to, especially you. It was so simple all those years. I was doing just the opposite, you know, and it was so simple, and it worked. And those kind of things, when they happened, you know, it gave me a little bit more faith in the program, you know. Like I said, I was reading that sign out there, you know, we love you in Westwood. I would never believe that when I was new. Nobody could possibly love me. And if you told me you loved me, it's because you wanted something from me. What is it? And that's the kind of attitude I had, and that's the way I felt when I came around here. I didn't believe anybody could possibly love me. You might talk to me because of him, you know. I mean, he's in AA, he's Mr. Wonderful now, he just don't drink today, you know. He's not doing anything else. I mean, the grass is 3 feet high, you know, and the walls need painted, you know. There's all kinds of stuff that needs done after all these years of drinking and not doing anything. But he's in AA now, and they told him, you don't have to do nothing, just don't take a drink today, you know. And he certainly wasn't a person that you said easy does it to. Because when he was drinking, he worked 3 jobs. And now he's not drinking today, and he's doing easy does it. And he quit 2 of the jobs, we're down to 1, and we lay on the couch and go to meetings, you know. And I didn't see where too much stuff changed. We used to be out till 4 in the morning drinking. Now we're out till 4 in the morning drinking coffee and talking. What's so wonderful about this? You're still not doing anything here, you know. And we kept arguing, and it was real hard. It was real hard because I was told when I came into Al-Anon that if I work my program and I leave him alone to work his, someday it will be all right. But I had to mind my own business. And I was told that the first piece of wisdom I'd learn in Al-Anon was to keep my big mouth shut. And I had a lot of trouble with that because I knew all the right answers. That's the way I felt. And I wanted to help him. He needed help bad. Anybody could see it. And I wanted to help him. I tried to set a good example for him to follow, because he had to follow somebody's example. He needed it. So I had a lot of trouble also with the women in AA. I felt so inferior all the time, and I had no confidence in myself. And I went to an AA meeting with him, and I'd sit there, and I was so afraid of AA people. I was petrified of them, and if I could have crawled inside Jack's body, I would have, because I was so scared. And I remember this woman said to me, "Honey, there's nothing wrong with you. You do not have a problem. He does." And I thought, "Who are you kidding?" But I didn't say it because I was scared. I knew there was something wrong with me, and I'm telling them, AA ladies, there is something wrong. And then I go over to Al-Anon and I'm telling them there's nothing wrong with me at all. So I was crazy. I wanted to be sick in this program and I didn't want to be sick in that program, you know. Oh man. So I'm trying to find me the first year and he's trying to find himself. And my daughter, I got her in Alateen. I didn't know what to do with her either. I couldn't help her. He couldn't help her. So I drug her there. By this time, her and I weren't pals anymore. We were hating one another. We were competition. I took her to Alateen. She screamed and cried. And she hated it. I handed her over to her sponsor, closed the door, and locked her in. And about 4 months after that, it was okay. She got used to it. She kind of liked it. And she was doing fine. When she was 17 years old, she came to me and said she wanted to quit school and get married. She had 4 months of school to go, and I begged, I pleaded, I did anything and everything I could. She wanted to quit. She quit school and got married, and she quit Alateen. Once you have alcoholism, you have it. And for the next 10 years, my daughter and I suffered because she was away from the program, and she hated me. And I could hear it in her voice. And she'd call me every single solitary day, every day, without fail, to ask me to do something for her. I don't care what it was. Take me to the store, watch the baby. It doesn't matter. She was testing me because she wanted me to prove to her that I loved her. And I'm in Al-Anon now, and they're telling me that I have to start doing for myself. Be good to yourself. And so I had to tell her no a lot. And I'd hang up the phone and cry and call someone in Al-Anon and go to another meeting. I went to 5 and 6 meetings a week for a long time because I needed them. And it was real tough going with that girl. It was real hard. Meanwhile, I'm doing what I can do and now it's going to more meetings. I'm trying to keep my mouth shut, mind my own business, stay off his back, do all those kind of things they told me to do. Not that I believed they would work, because I didn't. I really didn't think they'd work for me, in my case. I thought I was unique. And I remember telling Chuck that I didn't need steps. And he told me that I was unique. He said, very few people come into this program that don't need those steps. And I said, I know that, but I don't. He said, well, why don't you just try some of the slogans? And I said, fine, I could handle that. They're easy. And that's the way I felt in the beginning. I thought this first step, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and their lives had become unmanageable. I thought that we meant Jack and I. That's what I thought that meant. And I thought, somehow, I'm going to trick him and I'm going to tell him that I think that I'm powerless and my life's unmanageable, and him and I will do this stuff together, and that way he'll get it done. And I was going to pretend that I was sick, you know. There was no power greater than myself, so I didn't have to worry about that, you know. So in the beginning, what I did and what I had to do is I did believe that the whole Al-Anon group together was more powerful than me, because if every one of them was like me, put them all together and there's lots of power. And that's what I had to do in the beginning, is use the group as my higher power. God was something that wasn't mentioned in my house. And by the time I got to Al-Anon, if someone said God out loud, I just like got real upset, because the only thing I could do was spell it. And how they could say it out loud in meeting. I was waiting for someone to upset the table or throw their coffee or something, and they didn't. They didn't do that. And by me getting faith back in people, I was able to get faith back again in my higher power, who I choose to call God today. But meanwhile, my other little girl was 2 years old when we came in here. Came to the programs. So she's like one of them type people. She doesn't, alcoholism and alcohol and all that stuff doesn't mean too much to her. You know, she thinks meetings are boring, and why is it necessary? And I remember when she was 7 years old, she was outside playing, and she come running in crying, and she said, Mary won't play with me. And I said, why? And she said, because she doesn't like me. And Jack said to her, well, I don't know why everyone doesn't like you. You're a nice little girl. And she said, Daddy, everybody doesn't have to like you. And she was 7. I was in Al-Anon 4 or 5 years to learn that. That took me a long time. And the phone was ringing one day and it just like wouldn't quit, and I had had it. And she just real said, Mommy, they're your friends calling you because they love you. And I answered the phone with a different attitude. And she knows things that took me years to learn, because she grew up with both programs in the home. And she's like a program person, and she doesn't even know she's a program person. And it's real neat. And I always said that I didn't work. I wouldn't work. I wanted to stay home. I think when Jack was sober a couple of years, I was in Al-Anon a couple years, so then I could manage to go outside on a porch and let people see me and talk to me. You know, I was like not afraid anymore, because I was becoming myself, and getting my own identity was so important to me. And we were in debt, to say the least. So I did go to work for 2 years, got out of debt, and I quit. I quit work. And I'm back at home again. I wanted to raise my children and be there. So I'm one now for letting go and letting God. I believe that it works so much better in my life that way. And about 2 years ago, I guess, and my husband kept on my back about, well, you know, Jackie's in college now and going into her second year. I mean, have you done your job? Have you raised your children? I want to get a job. And I said, I'm not ready. If God wants me to work, I will work. And he laughed. And so I guess it was about a month later, my next door neighbor called me, and I see her twice a year in passing, and she asked me if I wanted a job. And I thought, oh, geez, I got to say yes. So I said yes, and I went to work. I worked there about a month and a half, and I didn't like that particular job. But God got it for me, so I had to stay with it. And I found something better. So I have been working ever since. And I got the second job. One of my pigeons got it for me. She said, we need somebody at work. And I went up there and worked a week, and my other neighbor across the street called me, and she said, how would you like to come to work for me? So God got me 3 jobs, and nobody believed me. But that's how I'm working, because I never put an application anywhere, because I didn't want to do that. My preference is not to work, but right now I think it's good for me, because my life has changed since my youngest moved out now. It's like, it's a new part now of my life, because I'm no longer, you know, the mother at home, and there's no children there anymore. And when she moved out, it was like another crushing blow, and it was hard. So it's good for me not to be there all the time. It's good for me to be out working. The little girl that got married and left the program, she started getting sick here like 3 years ago, and my mother called me, and she said, I don't know, by this time my mother was living with my daughter. And she said, I don't know what we're going to do with her. She just lays on the couch all the time, and she's just depressed, and Dan, I'm sick. I don't know any answers except the program. And I went up, and she was on the couch, and I went over, and I kicked the couch. I said, how about let's get up off that couch? Because I did that too. I'd put my house coat on and I'd lay on a couch and think. And the only thing that did was make me worse instead of better. And I kicked that couch, and she said, Mommy, I'm so tired. I can't get up. And anyway, she started to cry, and she came back to Al-Anon. Or she came to Al-Anon. She was in Al-Anon before. She came to Al-Anon. And I guess she was just coming to meetings for 2 weeks, and we found out that it wasn't depressed, it was leukemia, and that's why she was so tired. But I'm so grateful she came to Al-Anon first, because she got the Al-Anon spirit, and all my friends and Jack's friends, they all know Debbie, so she got lots of support. And she got lots of cards, and she's just, it'll be 3 years in Thanksgiving, and today she's doing fine. And they wanted me to get people to donate white blood cells, and I start calling people in the program naturally, and the blood bank in the hospital called me and begged me to stop sending people. There was just so many people that were going. People called and asked me if they could, and they thanked me for asking them. It was just the neatest thing. It was just devastating. It was wonderful. And Jack and I we're really rich, not financially. We can afford today to get our car fixed when they break down and things like that. And we have food. And my youngest one, now she's in her third year at Pitt. and she's on the dean's list. She's a pianist. She doesn't play the piano, mind you. She's a pianist because she's into Bach and Beethoven and things like that. And she sings with this Heinz Chapel Choir, and she's special. She's a product of the programs, and she's a special kid. And we're really rich because we do have, and we're blessed with, a nice family, and are all program people, most of them. And it's nice, and we're rich in that way. And I am so grateful that I am a member of Al-Anon. And I can learn from other people's experiences. And one thing I have never done is I've never left Al-Anon because I always believed that the answers were here. And I saw other people go away. And then I saw them come back, and they were worse than they were here before. So I learned by that, and I've never left. I kept coming back. And as long as, you know, I kept coming back, the miracle of Al-Anon happened to me because I fought it, and I fought it hard. But I don't have too much more to say except I love you, West Virginia. Thanks.
I'd like to thank Janet for such